And welcome to Live from the Left Coast. I'm Ian Masters. We're joined today by Peter Lance, who's a five-time Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter. He's the author of 1,000 Years for Revenge, Cover-Up, and the novel First Degree Burn. He's a former correspondent for ABC News and has covered hundreds of stories worldwide for 2020, Nightline, and World News Tonight. His just published book is Triple Cross, How Bin Laden's Master Spy Penetrated the CIA, the Green Berets, and the FBI, and Why Patrick Fitzgerald Failed to Stop Him. And later in the program, we'll be taking listener calls. And so, Peter Lance, you've, much of what happened prior to 9/11 is sort of slowly, some kind of picture is emerging. But clearly, on the whole issue of 9/11, in spite of the 9/11 Commission, it's worth noting that the two co-chairs of that, Hamilton and Governor Keene, after having completed the commission, they come out with a book later where they said, well, the FBI, no, not so much the FBI, but the FAA and the military lied to us or withheld information. So do you think we'll ever get any clarity on this stuff, or let alone, or more to the point, will we ever get any accountability?
Well, that's a great question, Ian. That's exactly why I wrote this book. It's the third book I've written, and what I decided to do is to focus on the one intelligence agency of the Big Five, which includes the CIA, the DIA, the FBI, the NSA, and the State Department has a service, to focus on the one that you could actually audit. You know, it's impossible for an American citizen to audit the NSA or the CIA or the DIA. It's all in the black. But the way you could do what I did was to focus on the many cases in the Southern District of New York that were the Al-Qaeda-related cases, because up until 9/11, as you know, they fought the war on terror as a series of legal cases. And I did this exercise purely because, as I said in the beginning of the book, my son was at Stuyvesant High School a few blocks away. I knew a heroic fire marshal, Ronnie Buka, who died that day. And I just decided, you know, could this happen and will it happen again? Answer those questions. So I put one foot in front of the other and I focused on these two offices. And I did an audit, if you will, that the 9/11 Commission did not do. And the reason they didn't do it was because many people on the commission, on the staff, and three of the commissioners were related to the Justice Department directly, particularly Jamie Gorelick. So, and their senior counsel, Dietrich Snell, had been a prosecutor in the Southern District. So this is not an Oliver Stone conspiracy. This is, as Rory O'Connor recently said in a blog, it's a conspiracy to cover up incompetence. Well, and so what I did was I focused, and I don't mean to drag on, but I focused the laser beam of accountability. I name names in this book, and I focus it hoping that the public will be now sufficiently outraged post-Iraq, post-Katrina, post the failure of our government on so many levels, that the public will be sufficiently outraged to want the truth.
And let's just go back then and lay the groundwork that's in the book, because we're going back to the first attack on the World Trade Center. I mean, is that where we begin?
We actually need to begin a little bit before that, but that's an important point. Jamie Gorelick said, and by the way, I am not, as you know, if you've read at least the timeline in the book, I'm not a left-wing or a right-wing writer. I'm a truth seeker. So there are people on four different administrations I'm critical of. But Jamie Gorelick noted, one of the 10 commissioners, former deputy AG, that they were going to just focus on the last couple of years, 98 forward. They really focused primarily 1996 forward. What I did was in this particular book of the three, I took it all the way back to the murder of Anwar Sadat in 1981. But the main, if we look at Ali Mohammed, this extraordinary Al-Qaeda spy who was able to penetrate three of the U.S. intelligence agencies, the first time he really showed up on the radar was in the summer of 1989 when Bush 41 was in the White House. And over four weekends in 1989, the FBI Special Operations Group, the elite black bag unit that got John Gotti, they literally followed a group of Middle Eastern men from a key mosque in Brooklyn out to Long Island to a shooting range, and they photographed them with dozens of photos over four weekends. Of the men photographed, Ian, three were later convicted in the World Trade Center bombing. One murdered Rabbi Meir Kahane on December 5th, 1990. One was involved with the blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman in the Day of Terror plots to blow up bridges and tunnels into Manhattan. So all of these people, all trained by Ali Muhammad, were on the radar of the FBI in 1989, and yet Ali Muhammad himself was opened as an FBI informant on the West Coast in 1992. So obviously, people in different parts of the Bureau were not talking to each other, files were not being shared, intelligence was not being shared, and this just represents the first of many blunders on the road to 9/11.
And Ali Muhammad is an Egyptian, what was he, military intelligence?
Yeah, he was an Egyptian army major, fluent in four languages, including Hebrew. He was a member of the radical unit that murdered Sadat, but he escaped scrutiny at the time in 1981 because even then he was on an officer exchange program at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. He was then purged out of the Egyptian army when Mubarak took over, and in 1984 was adopted, if you will, by Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was then running the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, later to merge with bin Laden and form al-Qaeda. Dr. al-Zawahiri saw this man's potential. He was an army military commando, and he basically, the first thing he had him do was to join Egypt Air, and he worked for Egypt Air for a year, where he studied all their counterterrorism measures on air piracy. He then approached the CIA in Cairo at the Cairo station. They vectored him toward Hamburg, and he actually worked as an informant to try and penetrate for the agency a Hezbollah cell. The official word, or I don't know if there's ever an official word from the CIA, but the legend is that he blew his cover and was quickly severed by the CIA. However, Ian, he was able to somehow mysteriously get past Otero watch list, and on the plane on the way in 1985, September, on TWA flight from Greece, he meets an American woman, 10 years his senior, effectively seduces her on the plane, and they're married 6 weeks later at a drive-through wedding chapel in Reno, Nevada. He's now in Santa Clara, California, the heart of Silicon Valley, and he enlists in the U.S. Army as an enlisted man, avoiding the scrutiny of a OCS school, and ends up miraculously back at Fort Bragg at the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School, this elite training center for Delta Force and Green Beret officers. And his CO there told us that the chances of getting there, having been in the unit that murdered Sadat and being on a watch list, the chances of getting at the SWIC, they call it, Special Warfare Center, was like it would be easier to win the Powerball, but somehow he got there.
And what's your explanation for that?
Well, his explanation was that he believed he was helped by the CIA getting into America, and that he was helped by the FBI after he got in. Now, remember the tenor of the times. This was during the Afghan War. He went to the base in 87. He got discharged in November of 89. The Soviets didn't leave Afghanistan until February of 89. So that was the covert war that the U.S. was fighting, and we were supplying at least $3 billion in aid covertly, matched dollar for dollar by the Saudis. So it's very possible that Ali Muhammad was perceived to be an ally at that point and winked at. Even his training in 1989 more or less winked at by the CIA and the military. But it's very clear, Ian, that at a certain point he began expressing radical Islamic views. Like, they actually used him to make training videos at Fort Bragg. And in one of the training videos, which I obtained a copy of the transcript of, he talks about the difference between what he calls Darul Harp and Darul Islam. Darul Harp is a government without an Islamic that's not dominated by Islamic law, and Darul Islam is a government that is. He says openly to these officers, it is the responsibility of every Muslim to turn a country with Darul Harp into Darul Islam. He was talking about Saudi Arabia and Egypt, but he really might have been talking about the U.S. So clearly, his higher calling was to his radical interpretation of the Quran versus his loyalty to America. And by 1989, he'd become a U.S. citizen. He was honorably discharged. He was getting a pension in the Army Reserve, and yet he was loyal to al-Qaeda.
Well, that's the part of it that I always find extraordinary, and it seems to be pretty consistent with al-Qaeda. They don't hide who they are. I mean, it's amazing that they've been so effective in terms of penetrating and particularly being able to pull off 9/11, given that they don't hide their true beliefs.
Well, you know, Stephen Emerson, who we interviewed, was one of the first terrorism experts to focus on Ali Muhammad in his book American Jihad, said that he was clever enough as a double or a triple agent, if you will. He was clever enough to give tidbits to the feds to entice them. So, for example, in 1993, after he was opened on the West Coast by John Zent, and we should talk about Zent later on because that story in itself is a book, astonishing story, because Zent himself was involved in a grisly triple homicide case that distracted him for years. But he told Zent, Ali Muhammad, in 1993, that I am working with Osama bin Laden, I'm working with Al-Qaeda, I am training people in Khartoum, we're dedicated to overthrowing the Saudi government. He's telling this to his FBI control agent, and the control agent, this is one of the things that John Zent did that was good. He did a lot of things that were, you know, I feel that he dropped the ball on Ali most of the time, but in this case, he contacted the Pentagon, and they sent a couple of people out from Fort Meade, which is where the NSA is. We don't know if they were with the NSA, but they interviewed Ali, and then nothing happened. In fact, the FBI agent that later went to look for the report said it was destroyed. One of the things that I encourage, if you don't mind me mentioning my website, I have on my website right now, peterlance.com, my name.com, L-A-N-C-E. You can see the first part of this timeline that we have in the middle of the book. You can just download it as a PDF. And you'll see time after time after time, leading up to the World Trade Center bombing, how many times, Ian, the same faces showed up on the radar of the FBI. So the first thing that strikes you is negligence or gross negligence. And then eventually after the World Trade Center bombing, I believe what they begin to do is suppress evidence to cover up earlier embarrassments. Not, again, some draconian conspiracy theory, but literally the CIA, to protect the Bureau or the Justice Department's reputation for their negligence. And in doing so, they bracket key intelligence in Al-Qaeda, which effectively minimizes the Al-Qaeda threat to other agencies. They create their own walls, their own stovepipes.
Well, it's amazing to think that the first attack on the World Trade Center that came fiendishly close to being successful, and there would have been even right. more casualties had that been successful. One building was, they planned to have one building fall into the other.
Right.
So you would have maybe had up to 100,000 casualties, or 20,000 at least. That attack was masterminded by the nephew of the guy that masterminded the second attack.
Well, actually, in my first book, A Thousand Years for Revenge, and that book is backed up. You know, in this book alone, you can tell the audience that there are 50 pages of endnotes in Triple Cross. But in the first book, I have 1,500 endnotes, and they're all there. And these are sources that are like these. The sources are either internal FBI memos or transcripts of actual cases that the Al-Qaeda cases. But I prove in my first book that Ramzi Youssef, the architect of the first bombing, was truly the architect of 9/11. He was the genius. He was the engineer trained in Wales. He was had memorized Hawley's condensed chemical dictionary from cover to cover. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was actually a bit of a lounge lizard up until 1995. But when he and Youssef got together in Manila with two other individuals, Abdul Hakim Murad, Youssef's lifelong friend, who had been trained at four U.S. flight schools, by the way, and another individual called Wali Khan Amin Shah, who was beloved of bin Laden. It was Youssef who conceived of the planes as missiles plot. And again, this is another classic case of the 9/11 Commission getting it wrong. They talk about an early, when Youssef's bomb factory was compromised January 6th of 95, and while he had three plots in motion. Plot one was to kill the Pope, who was going to be there in a few weeks. They were going to put pipe bombs along the parade route. Plot two was the notorious Bojinka plot, which was they would get on board the first leg of a two-leg hop of a U.S. jumbo jet exiting Asia with U.S. tourists, plant a device over the center wing fuel tank of the plane, get off the plane, and as the plane took off for America over the Pacific or elsewhere, it would blow. They'd use this little kind, what I call a Casio watch nitroglycerin bomb trigger to blow the plane. And Youssef actually did a wet test of this device on a Philippine Airlines flight, December 11th, 94, from Cebu, from Manila to Cebu City onto Narita in Japan, but he put it one row back. He, just as he had miscalculated on the placement of the World Trade Center bomb so that Tower 1 didn't hit Tower 2, he miscalculated by about a meter and a half as to where the center fuel tank. So when he got off the flight and the plane, when the bomb blew, he killed a man in the seat, Japanese national, blew a hole through the floor, and would have destroyed the plane. So now they know how to do it. They're going to push it forward and do this times 12. That's Bojinka. The third plot was 9/11, full-blown, not just a little plane into the CIA as was originally reported in the media. That's what Colonel Mendoza, who interrogated Murad, told in a reported in a briefing paper January 20th. But he had Murad for 67 days. I did the most extensive interview with Colonel Mendoza in 2002. I returned from the Philippines with about 100 pages of heretofore classified documents that prove that the full-blown 9/11 plot was set in motion by Youssef in 94 and that Khalid Sheikh merely carried it out. So, again, this is another reason, Ian, that the FBI and the Justice Department wanted to remove Ramzi Youssef from the 9/11 plot. So if you look at the 9/11 Commission report, they moved the plot forward to 96 after Youssef had been arrested. They make it seem like Khalid Sheikh was merely pitching the plot to bin Laden then. Absolutely wrong. And in fact, the reason I know it's wrong, not just because of the Philippines documentation, but if you look at the authority in the 9/11 Commission report, nominated for National Book Award, what is their sole authority for the origin of the plot? Khalid Sheikh Mohammed himself, who's been tortured and waterboarded. Now, this is like asking David Berkowitz for the date of the first Son of Sam murder. He's completely unreliable. You know, he's either going to protect his nephew or he's going to give disinformation, even under torture. So, and we know how unreliable the testimony of torture victims is. So the point is that Ramzi Youssef, they could have stopped him. I prove in my first book prior to the first bombing when Bush 41 was in the White House. He then goes on to set the 9/11 plot in motion. They even miss, I have this in the book twice, Ian, they miss Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is at the same guest house as Youssef when he's arrested in Pakistan, same 20-room guest house. He hangs around long enough to give an interview to a stringer for Time magazine, says his name is Khalid Sheikh, describes Ramzi's arrest, and he's in the wind. The FBI gets there late. I prove in 96 that they go to Doha Gutter to grab him, and they hang around, and he escapes again. So they let the guy later credited as the mastermind of 9/11, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, escape twice. All of these are embarrassing dots on the road to 9/11 that the Bureau ultimately wants to cover up.
And, of course, we know that there was ABC did the special, which was highly politically slanted, based on the John O'Neill story. But O'Neill, of course, was a fascinating character, and he seemed to have more institutional knowledge about the Al-Qaeda than anybody else. And he, as they say in FBI parlance, had sharp elbows, and Louis Free shut him down. In fact, the ABC miniseries did not really pin much on Louis Free, but Louis Free was a disaster, was he not?
Louis Free was a disaster of epic proportions, but I want to say for the first time for the listeners in Los Angeles, I'm going to reveal that ABC ultimately optioned my book, 1,000 Years for Revenge, for their miniseries. And perhaps the greatest distortion in that miniseries was not so much the emphasis on Clinton's failures, and there were many failures in the Clinton years, don't get me wrong, but there was clearly a greater emphasis on Clinton's failures. But here's what the FBI miniseries got completely wrong. And you can go to the credits and you'll see my book. In fact, they had a gag order on me, Ian. I wasn't even supposed to talk about it, and they held off the final payment for my book for 30 days after it aired, okay? Anyway, ABC made John O'Neill look like the ultimate hero. They had John O'Neill directing the takedown of Ramzi Youssef in Pakistan, if you remember the documentary. I mean, the docudrama. They also had a character named Lou Napoli, this detective with the Joint Terrorist Task Force. They made him look like one of the heroes. He was one of the biggest screw-ups in the history of the road to 9/11. I can't even tell you how many mistakes Lou Napoli made. And yet John Miller, when they couldn't option my book initially, I optioned my book to NBC first. NBC was going to do an eight-hour miniseries. There was a bidding war with ABC for my books. I met Cyrus Narasta, the same writer who wrote the miniseries, The Path to 9/11. He had my book underlined, underscored. He sent me emails. Peter, your book's the only one we want. So I went with NBC instead. And basically, so what they did was they optioned John Miller's book, The Cell, which was a Hyperion Disney book. John Miller's book, The Cell, is such a limited view of the history of 9/11. It's so pro-FBI that he doesn't even mention Special Agent Nancy Floyd. And I ask your listeners again, go to peterlance.com, download the PDF for the first part of my timeline. You'll see that Special Agent Nancy Floyd from Texas almost stopped the original bombing by recruiting Ahmad Salem, an Egyptian undercover agent who infiltrated the cell of the blind sheikh. And literally, they were paying him $500 a week. He was blown out by a superior of Nancy's who didn't like her, didn't like him. And they ended up paying him, Ian, $1.5 million after the fact to do what he could have done for $500 a week when Bush 41 was in the White House. And what happened is in 3 months, he rounded up the blind sheikh and the entire Day of Terror trial. Louis Napoli was one of the control agents working with him who screwed up repeatedly. John Miller makes him the hero of his book, The Cell, one of the heroes. It doesn't even mention Nancy Floyd, which is like trying to tell the story of the takedown of John Dillinger without mentioning Melvin Purvis, okay?
So, it's interesting. There were some other talented women in the agency and the FBI that were onto things like the Colleen Crowley as well.
Colleen Rowley, exactly, yeah. Just before. Well, let me just, I just want
so
to...
So what does it say, though, mistake. About this, just what are we to make of this, Peter, that our leading law enforcement agency in terms of counterterrorism domestically doesn't seem to be up to the task? I mean, I guess in a way what you could say is that what do a bunch of MBAs from Brigham Young University know about Islamists, you know?
Well, I think that, first of all, the Bureau, there are many good, what we would call street or brick agents, the agents of first impression, like Nancy Floyd. And there are a number that I mentioned in my book. There are a number that are sources to me, and they're good people. But the thing is, they, as soon as they get out of Quantico, within a very short time, Ian, management, which is the collective term in the Bureau for their superiors, you know, special agents in charge, they begin a rather draconian, punitive way of controlling the way cases are done. And they open up OPRs or internal affairs investigations on agents at the drop of a hat. So they live in fear. In fact, on your 20th day plus one, when you're in the Bureau for 20 days, imagine this. They call it my KMA day. It means kiss my you-know-what day. And the reason they call it that is it means that if they try and open an OPR on me after 20 years, I can put my papers in and retire before they impanel the investigation. Now, no agency where you need investigators to have imagination and originality and think outside the box, no agency can operate with that level of punitive mentality. And what I found is, and this is why my book matters, I have a chapter at the end, why any of this matters, whether there was a master spy in the 90s or not. Why it doesn't matter, because the Bureau, Ian, has not reformed. The Bureau still does not have a computer system. How did I get what I did? I did data mining. I used FileMaker Pro. I used an iMac I used Google. And I typed in every Arabic name, every variation on every Arabic or Islamic name, and I was able to connect some amazing dots. And I'd like to talk to you later about Sphinx trading. And yet the Bureau to this day, Director Mueller told Congress in 05, it'll be 2009 before they get a proper system, a computer system. Their virtual case file system, they spent $178 million on, failure. There are a series of IG reports on the FBI since 9/11. The Inspector General of Justice. This is not Peter Lance's opinion. These are reports by benchmarks that talk about the hundreds of hours of untranslated Al Qaeda wiretaps that have gone untranslated. The fact that they can't hold on to people in counterintelligence, and yet they pass the Patriot Act, which I believe was completely unnecessary. This was just about people doing their jobs. They were already in place. There were systems in place. There was a FISA Act that was in place. And yet, that's what got Colleen Rowley ultimately to tell the truth. In the FISA situation in Minneapolis with Zacharias Moussaoui, this really great agent Harry Sammet. He was a Navy pilot. He got onto this guy. He knew that there was something wrong with a guy who wanted to learn how to fly a jumbo jet, didn't care to land it. He just made an application for a FISA warrant. He found out that he had over $30,000 in cash on him. He'd been all over the world to these a number of countries that are terrorist-related. He had probable cause for a search, and he went to the FISA courts, and he was turned down by headquarters in the FBI. And he later described that, Ian, as criminal negligence. Well, the Bureau has not reformed, so our country remains at risk. My children live in New York. I love New York. Our entire country is at risk because of the failure of the FBI to face Islamic terrorism. I mean, one of the things I have in the book is that there was a lawsuit brought by a former Arabic-speaking agent who was a great agent. He was passed over. So he brought a lawsuit, and he did depositions on Director Mueller and Dale Walton, who was one of the heads of counterterrorism. Do you know that Dale Walton didn't even know the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite? And Director Mueller didn't even know the association of Osama bin Laden with Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, who's like the spiritual key to 9/11? Now, this is reprehensible. And Americans have to say enough is enough and demand that the system improve.
Let me remind the audience again, I'm speaking with Peter Lance, the author of a new book, Triple Cross, How Bin Laden's Master Spy Penetrated the CIA, the Green Berets, and the FBI, and why Pat Fitzgerald failed to stop him. Of course, Pat Fitzgerald is the special prosecutor in the case of the outing of the CIA officer, Valerie Plame. And, the chief aide to the vice president has been indicted in that. Let me invite the audience to call in at 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735 is the number to call to have questions for Peter Lance. Triple Cross covers an awful lot of ground as we've been trying to sketch out the landscape here. It precedes 9/11 and the groundwork for all of what has happened is here, and we're talking about the dysfunction of the FBI. Peter, I mean, one of the things that's in your book that I find just unbelievably shocking is that the number two guy in Al-Qaeda was able to come to this country and raise over $500,000 to wage war against the United States, which he subsequently did?
Yeah. In fact, Ali Mohammed smuggled him in twice, Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri. The latest video fatwa that we saw Ian, it's worth commenting. With each one of these video fatwas, the production values increase. The last summer when Dr. al-Zawahiri appeared, he's the fellow with the little beard. He's got like a dot in the middle of his forehead, and he wears alternating black or white turbans, and he has a little beard. Coke bottle glasses. Dr. al-Zawahiri was in a studio with high-end graphics. I mean, like, it looked like NBC News headquarters in New York. I mean, so if he's in a cave, I mean, it's pretty amazing that he's able to issue these religious decrees. But he came in, smuggled again by Ali Mohammed, who is, I call him the Zelig of Terror. If you remember the Woody Allen movie a few years back, because this guy, the fictional character, appeared everywhere. Well, Ali was real, and he smuggled him in under the guise of fundraising for the Red Crescent, which is the Islamic version of the Red Cross. Now, here's the metaphor that I use to underscore the significance of this. Imagine if at the height of World War II, Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, was smuggled into America and did a tour of German churches around the country. I mean, that's what we're talking about here, okay? Now, it's true that in 1995, the awareness of Al-Qaeda for the average American wasn't anywhere near as well as awareness of the SS at the height of the World War II. But nonetheless, Dr. al-Zawahiri, many believe, is really the principal sort of operational, day-to-day operational leader of Al-Qaeda, which remains, by the way, a top-down organized institution, tightly organized as a Panzer division. It is not loosely organized. It has not been dispersed the way the government wants you to believe. That's just an excuse for them not finding these people. Do you know that they've shut down the Bin Laden unit at CIA, Alex Station? Bin Laden himself has never been indicted for 9/11. So if you look at President Bush's pronouncements in the weeks and months after the attacks of 9/11, it was, we've got to get him, public enemy number one. You know what I mean? Now they try and degrade Bin Laden and his significance, but they're just as lethal. That plot that happened last summer, it took MI5, it took the Brits to uncover this plot, the transatlantic airliner plot, was a carbon copy of the Bojinka plot. Terry McDermott, excellent reporter for the LA Times, who wrote Perfect Soldiers, the book about the hijackers, he wrote a great piece in the LA Times about how close this was to Bojinka, the second of the plots I mentioned in the Philippines with Youssef. The New York Times did the same. Guess what? Acetone peroxide was going to be the primary ingredient. If you look at the end, there's a, again, peterlance.com, go down to the bottom of the homepage, and you can see or go to FBI 302s that I have on the website. You'll see at the bottom on the right-hand column how to smuggle explosives into an airplane. It was a note that a mafia informant got from Youssef in 1996 when he was on the ninth floor of the MCC, Federal Jail, Lower Manhattan. It says you can use RDX and or acetone peroxide as an explosive alternative to nitroglycerin, I mean, which is what he used, as I told you, in the Philippines plot. So that was a carbon copy. And look at, you alluded to this earlier, Al-Qaeda always makes good on a failed plot. They tried to knock the towers down in 93. They succeeded in 01. They tried to blow up the SS Sullivan's a warship in the Middle East, and they had an inflatable with a bomb on it. It sunk. But they made good with the coal bombing, you see? And they tried to execute the Bojinka plot. Ramzi Youssef, Khalid Sheikh, and Murad, they failed. That plot last summer was a carbon copy, which is why, as Santayana says, he who forgets history is destined to relive it, and why we have to focus on this. And Patrick Fitzgerald, I prove in this book, Ian, was a party to a treasure trove of Al-Qaeda-related evidence in 1996 coming from Youssef to this mob guy, Scarpa Jr. There are dozens of FBI 302s at peterlance.com that you can just look at right now. And those 302s say, among other things, that Youssef had an active cell in New York City, that there was a tie with the Khobar Towers bombing. That brings us back to Louis Freeh's incompetence, because in his book, in his memoir, he devotes an entire chapter to Khobar Towers, and he says it's only Hezbollah, doesn't even mention Al-Qaeda connection, and in fact, his own bureau has an FBI 302 in New York in the Bin Laden Office of Origin in 96 that he somehow either overlooks or never knew about.
Right.
And then finally, a plot to hijack a plane to free blind Sheikh Rahman that Greg Scarpa Jr. got out of Youssef December 30th. That's on one of the 302s. Guess what? That threat showed up in a presidential daily briefing to Clinton in 98 and to Bush, the famous Crawford, Texas, PDB, Bin Laden determined to attack in the U.S. August 6th, 3 weeks before 9/11. It was important enough intelligence to bring to the president years later, and Patrick Fitzgerald participated in a suppression of that evidence, calling it a hoax and a scam. I prove in my book that it was not. And this is the man who put Judy Miller away for 85 days, who only got to the point of a minor obstruction charge against Scooter Libby, who never took the investigation all the way to Karl Rove or to Cheney himself. That's the man that has been trusted with this CIA leak investigation.
Well, I guess you're implying that he got the job because he's not going to get the goods.
I can't prove it, but yeah. I believe that Patrick Fitzgerald got that appointment because of the baggage that he carried that was well known in the Justice Department. Patrick Fitzgerald, if you Google Patrick Fitzgerald, apart from the Plum affair, apart from the CIA leak case, has incredible press, okay?
Right.
I mean, the Southern District in general.
He and Condoleezza Rice both have good press, and it sounds like there's a kind of a similarity here in terms of their culpability. It's pretty hard. I mean, in the case of Condoleezza Rice, now we learn from Tennant's book that's coming out that he and Kofa Black went in and saw her a few weeks before 9/11, and they say we held a gun to her head and we did everything but pull the trigger, warning her that Al-Qaeda was coming and it was going to happen soon.
Right.
And she gave them the brush off, and of course none of that appeared in the 9/11 the 9/11 council ends up getting a job later as her chief assistant.
Well, Philip Zelica, who was the executive director, preceded getting on the commission. He was on the Bush transition team on national security, and he co-wrote a book with Condi Rice. He was a crony of Condi Rice's. He and by the way, the Jersey girls, the four, you know, Kristen Breitweiser, Mindy Kleinberg, Lori Van Arken, and Patty Cazaza, who I spiritually, I dedicated this current book to my children, but I really, the Jersey girls are single-handedly responsible, those widows, for getting the 9/11 Commission into being, for extending its investigation period, for getting it properly funded. Their biggest criticism of the commission is failure to assess accountability, okay? And they were beside themselves when Philip Zelica was appointed, okay? Mm-hmm. And by the way, just again, we this is a debate that is so important, it should not be politicized on the left or the right, because Jamie Gorelick and Philip Zelica ended up being, she was the representative of the Democrats, or the left, if you will, and Jamie Gorelick and Zelica were the only two people in the entire commission staff that were allowed to go into the SCIP, which is a secure room, to look at all the documents. They then were able to write a report that was seen by the other commissioners. But so the average commissioner didn't get to look at all this top secret material, and yet this report was written. Do I have time to just describe one of the most catastrophic blunders on the road to 9/11 that Jamie Gorelick is tied to? Do we have time?
We do, but do you want to take a call, and maybe you can work it into the call?
Yeah, I'll be happy to. Sure.
Let's take a call from Jeff in Dana Point. Jeff, you're on with Peter Lance, the author of Triple Cross.
Thank you very much. I don't believe that the administration fabricated the 9/11, I mean, helped or created it. But I think that from what you're saying and what I've heard from so many others, it causes me to believe that they were intentionally negligent, that they brushed people off and so forth because they wanted this to happen. They wanted.
I've never gone to the point of saying it like a Reichstag fire situation, you know, where they wanted an event to happen. So they're, because the thing is, and when you go back and you look at this, there's a chain of events that go back to at least to Bush 41 through the Clinton years, and it's like there is an intent at some point to cover up negligence, and there are multiple attempts to cover up negligence, that to bracket the intelligence, and that has the overall impact of producing a massive intelligence failure, the greatest one since the Trojan horse, not just since Pearl Harbor. But I, you know, you don't even have to go to that level. You don't even have to go to the level they wanted it to happen. It's frankly so frightening that three administrations on you know, Democrat and Republican, two Republican, one Democratic, were so concerned about protecting the image of the Justice Department and the FBI and covering up their failures, that they looked the other way, if you will, as this was going on. So it was gross negligence. And, you know, I have a law degree, and let's face it, there is a difference between intent and negligence. But if you're killed by a drunk driver or you're shot to death with intent to kill, you're still dead, you know? And frankly, it's cause for great alarm.
Let's take a call from Barbara in Calabasas. Barbara, you're on with Peter Lance, the author of Triple Cross, How Bin Laden's Master Spy Penetrated the CIA, the Green Berets, and the FBI, and Why Patrick Fitzgerald Failed to Stop Him. Barbara?
Yes, hi. Actually, the reason I'm calling is to say that the passion that Peter speaks with and describes almost everything that most people who are into this would love to hear about and read about is probably, my guess, 5% of the American population. So when Peter says Americans wake up, they can't quite wake up when they don't even know who the Jersey girls are, they don't know who Fitzgerald is, they don't have any higher education to be able to have time to be interested or read. And if it wasn't for Pacifica, having Peter on the show and listening to him be so enthusiastic and bright, and as he just said before I got on the air, that he has a law degree, which makes me understand a little bit better where his passion is coming from. He knows more than than probably a million Americans put together. So it's really tough when you say don't, you know.
Well, let's have Peter answer.
Yeah.
Okay. Peter?
Well, you know, thank you, Barbara, by the way, for that compliment. I really appreciate it. You know, here's the thing. How is it that I do have, you know, I worked at ABC News. I have a law degree. Went to Columbia J School, and you know, I won some awards. But I am a lone wolf journalist. And ironically, it took a lone wolf journalist with the time and the tenacity to tell the story. This has taken 5 years. This book is the culmination of the. It's the last book I hope in my trilogy, and it's taken this long because I'm not beholden to anyone. You see, I don't have to go. Many Daily Deadline reporters, God bless them, and I thank them in the beginning of this book. I thank James Risen of the New York Times, Ben Weiser. I thank a dozen reporters who told part of the Ali Muhammad story before me. But the Daily Deadline reporters, many of them, have to go back to these same agencies to continue working every day, and they can't afford to aggravate the FBI the way I might by just having the unvarnished truth. And so I don't have any agenda other than to try and get to the truth. I don't have any political axe to grind to the left or the right. And it took, I think, a journalist like that to be able to get this story out. The New York Times, by the way, has avoided this book like you wouldn't believe. And I think that is that's really cause for alarm. I brought my investigative work to a reporter, I don't want to say his name, in mid-August. I showed him, I have a key affirmation or a smoking gun document on Fitzgerald in the back of the book. I showed it to him. He was amazed. He started taking copious notes. We met for dinner near the Times. He told me he was going to get it to an editor. He later told me in October, well, the editor said we'd been down this road before. Well, they'd never been down this road. I then wrote to Bill Keller, the executive editor. They got copies of the book. The silence is deafening. And I think part of the problem is Fitzgerald has chilled the arguably the greatest paper in America. They have multiple subpoenas out. Phil Shannon, by the way, is a great reporter who covered the Abel Danger story in August of 2005. I called him in mid-August. He took my call right away. He knows my work. I asked him for a quote relating to Abel Danger, and I said, I'm doing a book that has Fitzgerald. He says, wait a minute, I have to stop right there. Fitzgerald just subpoenaed my phone records. So there's a chill in the air that is significant, and it's a station, only a Pacifica station, I think, would really have the guts to see me describe this book as I have in this kind of detail.
Let's take a call from Pete in Mar Vista. Pete, you're on with Peter Lance, the author of Triple Cross.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call. I was very interested in your comments about John Miller. I was wondering if you could go into any detail about his connections with ABC News, his interviews with bin Laden, and then, of course, his authorship of the Path to 9-1-1.
Yeah, well, John Miller is a very curious character. He moves in and out of journalism and government in a way that I never would. And I'm not holier than thou, but my sense is that when you become a reporter, you're a reporter. What John Miller did was, for a time, he was a reporter in New York, and then he went to work for Bill Bratton when he was commissioner of New York. Then he went to ABC News and actually was co-anchoring 2020 with Barbara Walters. He conducted this famous interview, although people put brackets around it, because even Miller himself admits that when he, quote, interviewed bin Laden, he didn't speak Arabic and he had to submit the questions in advance, so he was nodding as bin Laden was talking, but he wasn't able to follow up or challenge him. But it's still, nonetheless, it was courageous of him to get the interview and to know enough about bin Laden to do it. So I'm not taking that away from John. And the book The Cell has many important points in it, and I've cited The Cell in several parts of my own book. But John, you know, went back, followed Bratton to L.A., worked in terrorism. And you know what John Miller is doing today? He is the principal PR guy for the FBI in Washington. He's the principal flack for the FBI, okay? So John Miller, when ABC decided to, even though they bought my book retroactively by default after, you know, NBC's miniseries went down, ABC literally, by using John Miller in that book, and they actually inflated the role of John O'Neill. Now, John O'Neill, God rest his soul, died on 9/11. John O'Neill did a lot of good things, and John O'Neill was probably the foremost person in the bureau beating the drum about the bin Laden threat. Absolutely. However, He had no idea that Ramzi Youssef was in Pakistan in 1995, that he had fled to this guest house. That was 100% the work of the Diplomatic Security Service, the $2 million reward program that was passed through a man named Brad Smith, who died of Lou Gehrig's disease, a great agent. There were DEA agents involved in the takedown. The FBI got there late. This agent named Brad Garrett showed up late. He later took credit for the Youssef takedown on 60 Minutes, too. Absolutely untrue. And how do I know this? Not only my own research, but there's a book called Relentless Pursuit. ABC bought that book for their miniseries, and then they just completely distorted the truth. They inflated the role of O'Neill, and they made it look like he was directing the Youssef hunt when he wasn't. So the Bureau always gets the media high ground. My book, The 1,000 Years for Revenge, was purchased by FX, NBC, and ABC, the same book, three times. And every single time, there was pressure from the development people to make the FBI look like the good guys, okay? And you can't do it if they're not, you know? I mean, I'm sorry, you know? And
well,
so,
this goes back to Hoover there, John, doesn't it? I mean, Peter, doesn't this go back to... This goes back to J. Edgar Hoover, that he was all about public relations. I mean, he didn't, you know, the FBI under him were the car thief bureau. They caught car thieves around the country to make it look statistically like they were doing something, but they didn't go after organized crime, you know, et cetera. Yeah. So it was all.
Totally. The Bureau today exists from the pathology that was created by Hoover. The series with Ephraim Zimbalist that ran for years on ABC, the notion that they always get their man. I mean, the reason I had the ability to do this story and know that the FBI was capable of failure is that when I covered the Justice Department and other agencies for ABC News, more often than not, the Bureau was wrong. And many of the agents that matriculated through New York, they did it because they had to for their career. They were afraid of New York City. I mean that, literally. They would live in Orange and Rockland counties. They'd get on the train at 5 o'clock. And in order to do this, you have to do what Nancy Floyd did. She behaved like the character of Popeye Doyle in The French Connection. She worked two separate shifts around the clock. She would get out there, and she broke this case. And you know what they ended up doing to Nancy Floyd? First of all, they opened a 4.5-year OPR, Internal Affairs Investigation, and they literally leaked a story to the New York Post, The Temptress and the Spy, implying that she was having an affair with her lead asset, Salem, which was absolutely untrue, proven by undercover tapes. And then she ended up getting suspended for 2 weeks. What kind of a signal does that send to the Clarice Starlings of the world, the bright-eyed, bushy-tailed agents that come out of Quantico that want to do the right thing? The FBI, here's the biggest problem. They are a crime solution agency, not a threat prevention agency. They come in after the metaphorical chalk mark is on the ground. So it's a completely different mindset. My proposal has been, for a long time, give it to the Secret Service. The Secret Service is a tried and true entity. They don't just protect the president. They do counterfeiting. They did the Salt Lake City Olympics. They do major threat prevention of major events. They're already existing. We don't need a new MI5 in this country, another agency from the ground up. Let's give it to the Secret Service. And I guarantee you, overnight, as long as they're properly funded, our security with respect to the bin Laden, al-Qaeda threat will increase exponentially.
Let's take a call from Linda in Burbank. Linda, you're on with Peter Lance, the author of Triple Cross.
Yeah, Peter, there's one thing that you failed to mention, that even after 9/11, the borders have stayed open. Bush has kept the borders open. I mean, Clinton has had a hand in that, too. But even after 9/11, the borders are wide open, in which anybody can come in here, meaning any terrorist can come in here and, you know, make another terrorist attack. In fact, there are Mideasterners that come through the southern border. You know, they're called OTMs, other than Mexicans. They pose as Mexicans. They go to Mexico. Mm-hmm. They learn how to fit in as Mexicans, how to act like a Mexican, how to look like a Mexican. You know, they learn all the Spanish they can.
Right. Well, let's have an answer here, because we're running out of time.
I agree with this lady that the borders are effectively porous in America. In fact, there's an important part of Ali Muhammad's story. He was using Canada as his means of infill. You know, there's exfil and infill. Infill means you bring a spy in. He was caught, listen to this, in 1993, Ali Muhammad, this is the year of the World Trade Center bombing, of the cell of which he trained. He's caught by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. The system works in Vancouver. He's trying to bring a guy named Essam Marzouk, a stone Al-Qaeda terrorist, in who's carrying Saudi passports. They grab Marzouk. Ali goes in to inquire. They grab him. He's sweated for like 12 hours till midnight. They're interrogating him. And then he goes, hey, you know what? I'm working for the FBI. And he gives him John Zent's number, his control agent on the West Coast. They call John Zent. John Zent vouches for him. They let him go. Okay? After they let Ali Mohammed go, and he was, understand, he was caught. He was captured. He then went on to plan the African embassy bombings. He trained bin Laden's bodyguard, etc. I want to get back very quickly to Jamie Gorelick, one of the things that she did. Mohammed Jamal Khalifa is the brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden. He is captured by the INS in Morgan Hill, California, December 16th, 94. He's funding the cell of Ramzi Youssef and Khalid Sheikh that spawned 9/11. He moves from the Philippines to California, and Stephen Emerson believes he was going to go to a meeting with Ali Mohammed, who was 26 miles away. The system, again, works, okay? He's got a death sentence hanging over his head in Jordan, so he's motivated to talk. They find a Newton PDA with a treasure trove of evidence linking him to the blind sheikh, to bin Laden, to the Youssef cell, etc. Guess what? The State Department initially says he's a terrorist. We need to hold on to him. Jamie Gorelick, at the behest of Warren Christopher and Jordan that wanted him, the Jordanians, pushed for him to be extradited to Jordan. And as a result of Jamie Gorelick's intense pushing, he is ultimately extradited to Jordan. A witness recants. The sentence against him is vacated, and he's in the wind. We had the brother-in-law of Osama bin Laden, who was funding the 9/11 Genesis cell, in our hands in 1994 into 95 for many months, and we let him go. And that was Jamie Gorelick. Not one word is in the 9/11 report. And I want to say this, not knocking a brother journalist, but those of you who have read The Looming Tower, The Looming Tower is a wonderful book, but it tells half of the story. He interviewed the same agents I did, Jack Clunan, you know, Lawrence Wright of The New Yorker. But guess what? He interviews Mohammed Jamal Khalifa. There are 20 references, not a word about this. So he doesn't critically examine the Bureau the way I do. This
well, look, for Peter, just in closing, okay. Peter, you, give us yeah. give us the story that you said that is the number one piece of evidence was missed on the road to 9/11.
Okay, listen to this. I got this by getting the Nocera transcript, the only one I'd never gotten. Point number one, 1991, we know that the FBI knows about Sphinx Trading, S-P-H-I-N-X. It's a mailbox store in Jersey City. They know that El Sayed Nocera, who killed Kahani, had a mailbox there, okay? Now, 1994, Patrick Fitzgerald names a list of unindicted co-conspirators in the Day of Terror case. On the list, Osama bin Laden, Ali Mohammed, and Walid al-Noor. I go and I find out who Walid al-Noor is. I get a certificate of incorporation for Sphinx Trading, and I find out that Walid al-Noor is the co-incorporated with another Egyptian named Mohammed al-Atras. Where do you think two of the 9/11 hijackers got their fake IDs in July of 01? The identical location. It's like 100 square feet. It's in the same building as the Blind Sheikh's Mosque, where half the six members of which were convicted of seditious conspiracy. All the FBI had to do was sit on it the way they sat on the Ravenite Social Club of John Gotti, and those towers would be standing. Go to peterlance.com. I did a Huffington Post a week ago Friday on this, and I have it in great detail. It's also in Triple Cross. It's one example of how you have to take the story all the way back, at least to 1989-90, and you begin to unravel the pathology that exists in the FBI. The only way we're going to get better is if we find out what went wrong, and that's the goal of this book, Triple Cross.
And just in closing, Peter, do you think that there will be any kind of inquiry or any efforts made to improve our so-called homeland security?
Well, I point out in the book, believe it or not, there's an entire section in my second book about an ends-means decision that Fitzgerald and others made in 96, where they buried this al-Qaeda evidence to keep some mafia cases alive and to cover a scandal involving an agent named DeVecchio. It's too complicated to get into. DeVecchio ended up getting indicted as a result of my book and other evidence last March 30th on four counts of homicide. If the Brooklyn DA, and by the way, it's the Brooklyn DA, not the feds, if the Brooklyn DA, Joe Hines, pursues that case and others in Congress care to focus on it, we could reopen the entire 9/11 investigation. That's what gives me hope.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Peter Lance.